Now, this is another in the oral history tapes sponsored by the Michigan Supreme Court Historical Society. And this one focuses on the Supreme Court career of Otis M. Smith, who served from 61 to through 66. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And we're sitting, this is Roger Lane representing the Historical Society. We're sitting on October 23rd in Justice Smith's office in the First National Building in Detroit. In order to get started, let's focus for a moment on when it was in your career as a young lawyer, or perhaps after you had served a good deal of time in government, when you first began to be aware of the probability or possibility of service on the Supreme Court. Was this sort of a childhood ambition, or did it come much later?
Well, nowhere in my wildest dreams could I ever have imagined that I would sit on the Supreme Court. I think, put it quickly in perspective, I started practice in Flint about the first of January 1951, and I was in general practice until the middle of 1957, when Governor Williams appointed me as chairman of the Michigan Public Service Commission.
Was that your first government
position? That was my first state position.
Oh.
I had been an assistant prosecutor in Flint in 1954 for just about half a year. It was something that I had done. I was a public administrator for the county by appointment of the Attorney General of the state, 55, 56, and 57, until I came into Lansing. But I have to tell you that I never sought public office in Lansing, or put it this way, that everything that I sought I lost. The ones that I did not seek, somehow they came to me. So,
were you personally acquainted with Governor Williams?
Oh yeah, yeah. I came into politics really because of Williams and because of St. Thomas More. In law school, I became enamored of St. Thomas More, the Lord Chancellor of England in the days of Henry VIII, the fellow who was beheaded because he would not pervert the law towards his king's ends. So he was beheaded, and I guess I was tremendously impressed not only with that kind of courage, but with the language that he used that was to be significant throughout my public life. And that was before he was beheaded. He said something like this: "I remain the king's good servant, but God's first." And I got the Holbein print of the painting made by Holbein, the Dutch painter, of Thomas More, and when I was in law school, and brought it home, I brought it to Flint with me, where I made my home, and had it framed, and I had the printer in Flint insert those words, "the king's good servant, but God's first," to remind me that I had a higher obligation as a lawyer, really.
You know, what this suggests is that something was embedded in your mind very early in your life, perhaps through the church, through the precept of your parents, that led you to appreciate that concept, that attitude.
I was brought up in a very religious family, but I cannot say that I was religious. And I guess the part of that remark from Thomas More about God's first was certainly applicable to me off and on in my life, but I'm one of those people whom the epic poem describes best as the hound of heaven is always looking for your soul, and I always seem to be resisting. But I say that and say that I'm not really, I'm basically religious, but I'm not an institutional church person as I perhaps ought to be. But I was just struck with the idea that Thomas More made that there were civil authorities to whom he was responsible and to whom he had loyalties. In this case, the king, who was, you know, the embodiment of the government. And I always wanted to keep in mind that I had this obligation to law, but I also had an obligation to a higher law, one of morals, which would go above law, and that I had a not in a narrow, dogmatic, sectarian sense or secular sense. Following some rule of some church, but that I not only had to satisfy the requirements of law, but I had to satisfy the law of conscience.
A moment ago, when you were talking just before we turned the tape on, you mentioned your mother and a saying that she often repeated that had, to me, religious overtones.
Oh, yeah. Well, my mother was always quoting the King James Version of the Bible all throughout her life until she passed here in 1979 at age 87. And of course, my father having died very early in my life, my brother and I, at least, we knew the Bible without reading it, because Mother Eva would certainly quote it to him. But you mentioned this thing about not being able really to be a hedonist, you know, about things and enjoy a lot of fine clothes and cars and things of that kind, because even though I think I told you I had the opportunity to drive a Cadillac, I never drove one when I was at General Motors, because I couldn't bring myself to the idea of consuming so conspicuously, and I always sort of figured that what the Bible said that my mother quoted was had a lot of truth in it. Better to mortify the flesh, exalt the spirit. So I thought I was doing that.